This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come.
About 100 different singers recorded that song, from Wilbert Harrison, who had the original hit, to the Beatles and Sammy Davis Jr. My guests are the ones collecting the songwriting royalties, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. This team has written many rock and roll classics for Elvis Presley, the Clovers, the Coasters, the Drifters, and Benny King. Their songs include Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy, Searchin', and Stand By Me. They not only wrote the songs, they often produced them. In fact, Lieber and Stoller were the first rock and roll producers to actually get credit on the record for their work. Rock and roll's greatest producer, Phil Spector, got his start as Lieber and Stoller's assistants. Rhino Records has just released a CD of Lieber and Stoller's classic songs. It opens with the original 1953 recording of Hound Dog, sung by Big Mama Thornton. This was the first session Lieber and Stoller produced themselves.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Well, Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The record we've been listening to, Big Mama Thornton's recording of Hound Dog, was your first major hit as songwriters and producers. You wrote the song for her. What was it about her that led to this song?
Well, Mike and I were invited to Johnny Otis's rehearsal studio to listen to and look at some of his artists. Big Mama was one of them. And she was really formidable. She was scary looking. She was big, and she must have weighed about, anywhere from 275 to 350. And she had this really gutty, guttural, growling sound in her voice. And the both of us fell in love with her. And we just loved what she looked like, and we loved what she sounded like. She sang Ball and Chain, and we decided to take off that minute and go to Mike's house and try to write something for her.
Well, how did you come up with this song, though?
Well, Mike was driving, and I was banging on the roof of the car, and I was trying to come up with something nasty that would be, at the same time, playable, that wouldn't be censored, you know? And the closest I could get to what I was thinking was, you ain't nothing but a hound dog.
So you were thinking four-letter word, epithet, and what
right.
You came up with Hound Dog.
Right, which sort of, you know, made it felt right, and it seemed like it would be passable.
Mike, let me ask you how you think Elvis handled the song differently from Big Mama Thornton.
How he handled it differently?
Yeah.
Well, he handled it very differently. He didn't sing it in the same tradition of blues intonation that Big Mama used. And also, the lyrics were considerably different because Big Mama's, the way the song was written for Big Mama is really about a gigolo. It's a woman complaining about a gigolo. And Elvis couldn't sing that song. So he sang a version of it, which I think, as I'm told, he heard from a lounge act in Las Vegas, that he heard singing the song in Vegas. Now, I had heard that he knew Big Mama's record and loved it, but it was only after he heard this lounge act do it that it seemed appropriate for a male singer.
You know, I think it was the first time Elvis sang Hound Dog on TV. It was on the Steve Allen Show, and he sang it to a little hound dog. It was very cute.
A basset hound.
A basset hound, okay.
Right.
Did you feel really kind of cheated by that? Here's a song that you wrote that was supposed to be an epithet, you know, about a gigolo, and it ends up with someone as forceful as Elvis making it into, you know, this guy, cute little harmless song on the Steve Allen Show.
We thought it was kind of dopey.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't offended. I just thought it was silly. That's all.
Yeah. Now, you wrote several songs for Elvis, including Jailhouse Rock. Why don't we play a little bit of that? Jailhouse Rock, written by my guests Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Now, you wrote a lot of songs for Elvis's movies. This was really one of the best songs. Some of the movies had really awful songs in them. Did you have to write some of those awful songs?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Oh, we loved writing the awful songs because they were more fun. Things like Steadfast, Loyal and True, you know, songs where he was supposedly graduating high school. I don't think Elvis graduated high school, but maybe he did. But we had to write these terrible songs.
How'd you feel about having to write terrible songs? Why did you enjoy it?
Because it was funny.
Uh-huh.
It was amusing.
Yeah, it was kind of like anti-rock and roll.
Well, the thing was that the problem was this. You got a script, and there would be a moment in a scene where they would want a song. Now, we would tell the director, we would tell Hal Wallace, the producer, we'd say, look, you know, we're not trying to get out of writing a song, but this is really a dumb place for a song, you know? I mean, the guy's about to go into the boys' room and comb his hair, and I don't know why he has to sing, I'm going into the boys' room to comb my hair. And they'd say, we want the song. So we'd write it. So a lot of those songs that shouldn't have been written were written and recorded, and they're there for posterity.
A lot of the songs that you wrote over the years were novelty songs, songs like Charlie Brown, Love Potion Number 9, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy. I think I just named all Coaster songs here. But how did you get so involved with novelty songs?
We didn't think of them as novelties.
We thought of them as dark dramas. We were both trying to imitate Tolstoy and Dickens, and I guess we just fell short of the mark. We wrote novelty songs because we're both essentially gag writers, and we like to tell funny stories and anecdotes. And this is just a way of telling funny stories set to music.
Well, let me play one of your novelty songs that's on the Rhino Records anthology that's just been released of some of your songs. And this is Charlie Brown.
Beep, beep, five, five, four, four, four. I smell smoke in the auditorium.
Everybody always picking on me.
That's him on his knees.
I was wondering if one of the reasons why you wrote so many novelty songs is had to do with that you were two white Jews writing for a lot of R&B groups who were black. I don't know how self-conscious you were about that, but I was thinking, well, maybe it was easier in a way to write songs that were funny as opposed to maybe the presumptuousness of writing something that was really heartfelt when you were writing for other people. Though you wrote a lot of those songs, too.
Well, to begin with, these two white Jews really experienced themselves as black. I was brought up in an essentially predominantly black neighborhood in South Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And Stoller can speak for himself, but he went to interracial camps when he was a kid. No, it's not that. We really felt that we were very black, and we acted black, and we spoke black. And it wasn't really till later on, when you hear these later songs, like 1959 and 60, the late Coasters things, mm-hmm. that are really kind of generalized rock and roll for mass market. But the early stuff that we wrote things like, our early songs were not really novelty, they were blues. Hound Dog is a buck dance blues for Big Mama. And Kansas City is a 12-bar blues. Certainly not a novelty song. All the early stuff, with Jimmy Witherspoon.
And Hard Times that we wrote for Charles Brown.
These are all blues. And we wrote exclusively for black artists because that's how we felt. And it wasn't until later on that we started to stretch a little bit and when we moved actually from L.A. to New York, started to write for a broader market.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And if you're just joining us, my guest is the songwriting and production team of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. And Rhino Records has just brought out a new collection of some of their rock classics. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller are my guests. Now, after you were writing songs for a while, you started producing the records of the people who were doing your songs. This was in the days before record producers were considered to be the auteurs of, you know, of the music industry. What was your approach when you walked in the studio? What did you take control of when you were producing a session?
Everything. From the song, the artist, interpretation, the arrangement, the sound, everything.
Selection of the musicians. Mike essentially picked all the musicians, handpicked the musicians, and did the bones of all the arrangements and played piano on all the record dates, or at least all the great ones. And I was essentially responsible for the performance of the singers.
Right.
And I directed the singers. We worked that way for 40 years, I guess. We're still working that way.
Why did you get into the production? Why did you want that control?
Well, self-defense, really.
We needed to protect the intention of our work because we had had a few experiences early on where we would deliver a song on a piece of paper, and it didn't come out the way we had intended it at all. It was another aesthetic entirely.
Give me an example.
And in order to make it sound the way we planned to make it, we had to do it ourselves.
For instance, we'd come in with what we thought was like a sort of a Texas shuffle, you know, a blues.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be on paper, and we didn't have a demo, and they would turn it over. Because we were somewhat hot, they'd take it that way, and they would turn it over to an A&R man, say at Capitol or at CBS, whatever. And these were good producers, but they had their own sense of what was correct and what was happening, and they weren't down into rhythm and blues. They were still rooted in swing and jazz at that time. And they would, you know, we would have something that should sound like either a Texas pickup band or Memphis Slim, and they would make a record that would sound like Tommy Dorsey or Benny Goodman's swing band, and it would just be wrong. And so after a couple of these disappointments, we decided to, in self-defense, to learn how to produce records ourselves so we could make our songs come off the way they were intended.
One of the things that you are famous for having pioneered was bringing a string section to rock and roll or to rhythm and
blues.
That
was Mike's fault.
Yeah, let me ask you, you know, on the Drifters recording of There Goes My Baby, that's the classic example of you bringing strings on. What went through your mind to do it?
I can tell you exactly what was on my mind. Just the line, the melodic line. And I was playing it. I used to joke about this one because it sounded like Borodin and I sounded like one of the Caucasian melodies. And
I don't know if you get the pun, but he's been saying this for many years, and I always thought it was funny.
Right.
The fact that he would use a Caucasian melody on this.
But it was Jerry heard it, and he said, "That sounds like strings." And I said, "Why not?" And so, why not? We had five violins and one cello, and they were all basically playing in unison.
Because Jerry Wexler wouldn't spring for six violins and two celli.
Was it hard to find string players who could play with the right spirit on a session with the Drifters?
No, they didn't have to play with the right spirit. They just had to play a Caucasian melody. And so we hired a lot of Caucasian string players.
Now, another thing that happened on this record was you introduced a Latin rhythm that you used.
The Bayonne rhythm was one that both Jerry and I adored. It was I first heard it in the film Anna with Silvana Mangano, and they had a small Brazilian group, and the record Anna became a fairly big hit, and it was a popular melody, and I just loved the rhythm on it, and we had always looked for a place to use it. We'd used it maybe once before on a early record that was not particularly successful. And we had the opportunity to use it on this record date. And there happened to be a timpani left over from another recording session in the studio. And we used it. Now, the drummer was not a percussionist. He was just a trap drummer, and he didn't know how to use the tuning pedal on the timp. So he played one note throughout the entire thing, which gave it a rather bizarre, muddy bottom with all kinds of weird overtones. It was kind of fascinating, though. And that's where we first had a successful use of that Bayonne rhythm, which, in case anybody's wondering, is boom, 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 boom.
Which finally was used, I think, and is responsible for maybe over 1,000 hits, because this Brazilian rhythm supports a slow ballad without the ballad seeming to be slow or sluggish. It keeps it moving, and everyone from Burt Bacharach to Phil Spector to you name it have leaned heavily on the support of this rhythm pattern.
Boom, boom. There she goes. There she goes. There she goes. There she goes.
My guests are the songwriting and production team of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Are you still writing songs together?
And apart. Yes, we are.
Yeah.
How often do you see each other?
Too often. We see each other about twice a week.
So
sometimes three times a week. We talk every day.
So you still have a close working relationship?
Absolutely.
You were saying that you really thought of yourselves as being Black when you were writing for Black R&B groups early on. When did that change? When did you start thinking, well, I guess I'm really not Black. I'm really white. And was there a point in your careers when you started thinking that it was presumptuous to think of yourselves as being Black when, in fact, you were white?
I don't really remember when it happened. I don't really remember when the transition, I don't think it was abrupt. I think it was gradual.
Uh-huh.
And because you see, when I was a kid growing up, it was where I came from, it was hip to be Black, you know? I mean, to be white was kind of square, you know? And the clothes, you know, you had to dress a certain way. And if you looked a certain way and you spoke a certain way, then you were okay. And if you didn't, then you were lame. And all, you know, teenagers especially are very, very conscious about what is hip and what is lame and what is square and what is out and what is in, you know? And, I mean, I grew up right there in the middle of a Black culture, and I knew dead on what it was, you know? I mean, firsthand.
And I belonged to a social club in Harlem from the time I was 13 years old, and I used to go up there every weekend. And from there, of course, I used to hang out on 52nd Street and listen to all the jazz musicians in the little clubs. So that was a part of my life.
When I met Stoller, he was sporting a goatee and he was wearing a beret, and he would stand hunched over like he had a humpback, and he'd smoking, and he would say, "Mmm." You say anything to him? You say, "You want to go to the movies?" He say, "Mmm." Or you say, "You're hungry, man? Let's go eat." You go, "Mmm." Because he was like that, right? It wasn't until he was about 21 that he started talking.
So let me ask you again if there was a point when you started thinking that it was presumptuous to think of yourselves as being Black.
I think when Baraka turned to me one day, because Leroy Jones had been my buddy for years, and Leroy in New York told me that I was the greatest living black songwriter. This was when he was Leroy Jones. And about 2 or 3 years later, when the revolution started to happen, right, he informed me that I was white.
How did you respond?
I sort of felt like I'd been betrayed.
I think he was astonished to find out.
I started sitting in the front of the bus.
I haven't asked you, what is your style of working together? Let me go back to when you were writing hits nearly every day. What was your style of working together? Would you be in the same room?
We'd be in the same bathrobes. We were matching bathrobes. Yeah, we'd be in the same room. Actually, Stoller would normally sit at the piano, and I would sort of stalk around the room and smoke. Now, neither of us smoke anymore, so it's taken half the fun out of work. But he would sit at the piano and fiddle, and finally, I don't mean fiddle. I mean fiddle with a piano, you fool.
And Lieber would stalk around the room screaming.
Right.
And if something stuck to the wall, something he screamed, we work on it.
We take a biopsy and work on it. But now that was the early days. The way we work these days when we work, I usually have a fix on a lyric and I'll bring in 8 or 10 or 12 lines and I'll give it to Mike and he'll go home and work on it because this way we can have some time alone.
Which is a delight. And or I will write a melody or half a melody and lay it on Jerry and say, listen, what can you do with this? And then we'll get back together and tear it apart and start over.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Righto. Yeah, it was fun.
That collection of some of the classic songs of Lieber and Stoller is on Rhino Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.